Hello, friend, and welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast, a part of the Agora Podcast Network and the original Tudor History Podcast, celebrating 15 years of Tudor podcasting this year. So this is a supplemental episode. This is a chat that we had with Brigitta Webster of Eating with the Tudors a couple of weeks ago. Members of the YouTube channel and patrons of the podcast on Patreon get extra episodes and author chats. We do monthly author chats with authors, I suppose. That's why they're called author chat. And in January, we talked with Brigitta. Now, Brigitta is somebody who is incredibly special to me because, gosh, I remember when she and I first started writing back and forth to each other. It was, I think, maybe 2016. I want to say 2015, 2016, something like that. And I actually went to her old house. She's since moved, but I went to see her and we did a live episode with Melita Thomas of Tudor Times. I think that was 2018, 2019. And she has been to TudorCon. She came to TudorCon in 2019 and she's speaking at TudorCon this year on cooking and food. She's just a fabulous, fabulous person. She just has the most wonderful energy. She's just so generous with her time. I can't say enough wonderful things about Brigitta Webster. So I was happy to have her on, and I'm happy to share this chat with you. And if you want to see her at TudorCon, along with some other fabulous authors and podcasters and writers and wonderful people, we have, I think, just 10 tickets left. I believe it's 10 the last time I checked. So it will sell out. We will do streaming tickets as well. I'll have those available for sale in June or so as it gets a little bit closer. TudorCon is in September, September 20th to 22nd at Agecroft Hall in Richmond, Virginia, which is a Tudor home. You've probably heard me say this already, but if you haven't, it's an actual Tudor home that was brought over brick by brick, piece by piece, because a wealthy tobacco merchant wanted to have a Tudor home. So well done him. He made it happen. Anyway, so you can go to englandcast.com/TudorCon to get tickets, assuming there still are some left when you listen to this. And if you want to attend these author chats that we have live, you can join the podcast at patreon.com/englandcast to join on Patreon. That's patreon.com/englandcast. Or just click join this YouTube channel if you are listening to this on YouTube. All right, Phantasmo, thank you.
I'm recording now. So carry on.
Yeah, and so I am so glad it came like that because I really love every single minute of what I'm doing now. I am really hunting down every single authentic recipe to the recipe I can get my hands on. I have started to take lessons in calligraphy so I can figure out what the original text actually is saying. And yeah, I think it's been my destiny. I think it's meant to be that I do this. And I just love it because it shows that Tudor history is global. You don't need to be English. You don't need to grow up or live here to find this utter love and interest in Tudor history.
So tell me about your research. Like, how do you research these recipes and how has your research changed from 15 years ago when you first started doing this to now? You mentioned paleography. I'm wondering, like, what your research process is for getting these recipes. And then I have some follow-up questions based on what you say.
Yes, I guess I started like most people and bought books that claimed to have authentic Tudor recipes. And for a while, I was very happy and I recreated those recipes until somebody who pointed out to me, do you realize they're actually modernized? And I thought, modernized? Oh, what can we do about that? So I then started to look into recipe books that at least took their recipes from an authentic source, and that gave me the source. So I started to look into the authentic recipe, the 16th century text. And for the first time, did I realize, oh my word, this reads totally different. You cannot really look at a modernized recipe and believe that this is what it was like. It's a real journey back into history. And in the beginning, I have to confess, I had real problems reading, deciphering these authentic recipes. I mean, even the printed versions, anybody who's looked into 16th century English realizes very quickly everything is different. The spelling is different. Even within the same recipes, do you often get the same word spelled in three different ways? But most most challenging is the fact that half the recipe, or what we expect to be there, is missing. Big chunks of what to do missing. Measurements, very, very rare, if at all. Often the main ingredient doesn't appear. And you think, whoa. And this is where it comes in really useful if you are a competent cook. Because you look at the few ingredients that you can find, you roughly know what type of dish this could potentially be, what is missing and what's interesting. And you start to form a picture, you know, a little bit like a jigsaw. You've got bits and pieces and you start putting the bits and pieces together. And it's really, really hard in the beginning, and you make many mistakes. And the best way to test the mistakes is by recreating what you think the recipe is telling you. And if it doesn't work, you know, back to the drawing board. There's a vital mistake somewhere. But that's what makes it so exciting, because you never really know what to expect.
How many times have you had to recreate, like, a recipe? Have you had to recreate any more than like 10?
It depends. Some I still haven't quite figured out, and I still have to go back again and again. What helps is that what is helping is the fact that all over Europe, some recipes were sort of international, but they all had their take on it. And different recipes go into a little bit more details in different sections. So you have to start looking at how did the Germans do it? How did the Italians deal with it? And the Italians, oh God, I love the Italians. Those were the cooks, or those that wrote out the recipes, that really supplied the most detailed recipes. And in all fairness, also the tastiest. They really knew how to cook then. So, yeah. Sorry. But you learn a lot by studying the Italian recipes. And then you go back to your English source and you realize that must be the same one, but the English one isn't mentioning step one, step four, but you can fill in the gaps by comparing it with other recipes from.
And what are these recipe books that you're looking at? I mean, I know, like, later in the early modern period in England, there were some cookery books, but like with the Italian, are these cookery books? Are you looking at like household records of purchases, like of grocery, or like what are you looking at?
It very much depends. Obviously, you have the handwritten recipe collections by sometimes just a housewife, but sometimes by more professional people. And then towards the end of the 16th century, you are beginning to see professionally printed cookery books, and their sole task is to sell this book to people who want to cook. In the 16th century, the market is very much still for the male cook, the male chef, and you can tell. But around 1600, or very close to 1600, do you start to see the first cookery or recipe books geared at the ladies of the house? Which is very interesting, because that clearly shows us, now it's also acceptable for the lady of the house to do some cookery, where before it would have been the maid or, you know, somebody in the kitchen, totally anonymous. We would never know who they were, unless the very posh kitchens, and they always employed male cooks. The French cooks were, funny enough, the most popular ones. I do not understand why the English royal family, the Tudors, employed French chefs, where I would have gone for an Italian, definitely.
Okay. And what, like, these books, is it like Gervase Markham? Is that who, like, some of the...
The best example is probably Scappi's Opera. It's a massive cookbook. I think it's got 600 pages, if I'm not mistaken. I've never counted them, but it's the biggest one. And it's full with recipes, one recipe after the other, where Markham's book is more a general advice book, which combines recipe, cookery, but also gardening and how to store your food. It's a lot more general. And obviously it's also 17th century.
Okay.
So it's a little bit later and not quite Tudor. I mean, his mindset was that of a Tudor gentleman, but he actually wrote, and his works were printed in the 17th century.
Gotcha. And okay, so I have questions. My first question is, what class of people these cookery books would they have been marked? Okay, did regular people cook at home? I'm thinking about like ovens and fires in crowded cities. So were regular people cooking, like just lower class people, like? Do you see where I'm getting?
Absolutely. Absolutely right. And that's where it gets very interesting, because there are huge changes taking place between early Tudor and late Tudor. In the early Tudor period, all cookery books, all recipe collections are written by and written for the absolute elite.
Okay.
They were only to be found in the richest, the wealthiest houses. Anybody lower in the scale would have obviously cooked, but not even every house would have had cooking facilities. And that's quite interesting, especially in urban areas. We know that the poorest people had no way to cook, nothing, no oven, no open fire, nothing. They were totally reliant on street food, which is the Tudor takeaway, isn't it? The equivalent of Tudor takeaways. These were
there shared ovens or anything, like in some places?
The ovens were often shared by the baker. That's why the baker was so very essential to all communities, because he would bake his own bread first, and then he would allow the women to come and bring their bread to be baked for a little bit of money. And that obviously was the case in the country as well as in town. But in town, you get those really, really poor people who didn't even have the facility to make their own bread, and they had to go and buy second class pies every single day, or pottages from those stalls that were open almost 24 hours a day, every day. And they had to be, because otherwise people would not have been able to feed themselves. But towards the end of the 16th century, you see, and you know, the printing press has a lot to do there. One of the first genres that the printing press in England geared to was actually recipe books, which is very, very interesting. They instantly thought, oh, yeah, we can find a new market there. But so from about Edward onward, Mary, definitely Elizabeth, you see the price of those printed cookery books coming down. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they obviously appeal to the upper middle class. Mm-hmm. Now, these are the people, the newly rich people. These are the merchant class. These are the people who made money. They weren't born into money, but they became successful. They are the new gentleman class. They have money. They have no title, but they have money, and they are very keen to spend it. It's their way to show, look, I've made it here. I have arrived. I can buy books. I can buy cookery books. And this goes hand in hand in appealing to the ladies of those households. And then you obviously get Thomas Dawson with his famous the jewelers, housewife's jewel in 1596, 1597, came in two parts, but was mostly sold in one big book. Yes, so within those 100 years, you see the cookery book becoming very, very popular and taking the middle class by storm.
There you go. Okay. And presumably then that upper middle class, they would have had a place to cook. So it,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely.
So you today recreating these recipes, ingredients, I want to know how you get these ingredients to be more authentic, like, because I'm guessing like flour today isn't the same as flour was. Like you go to Tesco's or Sainsbury's and get a thing of flour, that's not going to be the same as what Tudors would have had. So how do you account for that in your recipes and your cooking?
Right. I'll try to buy flour that's been milled locally. And we are very blessed here in Norfolk. We do have quite a number of small family-run flour mills. So I believe that's as authentic as I could go. Even in Tudor England, no lady of the house would have ground her own flour. That's one item you would always buy from somewhere else. But where I really, really try and I'm quite a stickler is I do use seasonal produce. So I would never consider buying and preparing a dish that is out of season, because in Tudor England I couldn't do it, so why should I do it? That in itself poses big problems sometimes. If you, for instance, look at, let's say, the quince, a very, very popular fruit in Tudor England. But the quince naturally only ripens in early autumn, depending on the weather, but early September, sometimes you get them as late as early October. But outside that window, you can't get quince. So I always have to prepare the quince a year ahead of when I need it. So if I know I'm going to provide an institution or a museum with some authentic Tudor food, and it's being laid on in July. I know I have to get that done the autumn previously. And the same goes for pear. I will not buy modern pear because the Tudors would have used a pear called the Warden. And the Warden pear, you can still buy trees. They are rare. You would have to get them from specialist nursery, tree nurseries, but you can still buy them. I've got my own trees, and they cook and taste different. And when you've tasted it, you can tell the difference. And I personally, sometimes when I read somebody else providing a authentic Tudor meal in July, and it says pear in wine or whatever, and I say, "Oh, is that the Warden?" And I say, "No." All right, okay, fair enough, but it's therefore not that authentic.
Could you preserve any of these, like with your quince? Do you?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And I'm using authentic 16th century recipe to preserve the quince. So I've got it ready to use to go into a pie or whatever when needed. I do it as far as I can. I try and do it the Tudor way. It's not always possible with meat or with fish, simply because food standards a bit different these days. So with fish and meat, I have to obviously stick to the modern fresh meat and not the preserved in tons of salt version. A, it would probably not be to everybody's liking, but yeah, I want people to keep safe as well at the same
You don't
time.
want to give people like salmonella and listeria like that.
Preferably not,
Right.
no. Touch wood hasn't
Yeah,
happened
right. Not totally. So tell me about your cook. Tell me about your book. And I want to ask you about your book and where people can get your book because we only have a couple minutes left. I want to make sure that we've got all of that in.
Right. Well, my book is the accumulation of many years of trying, testing various recipes. And for the book, I have selected the 100 best. And they take you all through the year from January right to Christmas. And what I liked was the fact that I provide the authentic text recipe plus my version. So people can compare it instantly. They can see how they compare. And I provided also a picture with each one so you get a rough idea what it should look like. And I've also managed to find a little bit of history about either that particular dish or the main ingredient, because I personally think that's really interesting when you can read up a little bit. Oh, I didn't know that. And wow, oh, Elizabeth had that for her birthday. Little bits of extra information.
What would we're recording this at the end of January. What's a good recipe for the end of January?
Oh, it's anything to do with Seville oranges. This is the season now where my whole kitchen is always smelling of Seville oranges. It's marmalade, Tudor marmalade, made with oranges, which was a newcomer. All the marmalade beforehand was made actually from quince. And it was only the last few years in Tudor England, so around 1590 to 1600, where we see marmalade being made from Seville oranges.
Interesting. All
Yeah.
right. So anything having orange marmalade on your toast or something is
Yeah, only the Tudor orange
cool.
marmalade is so thick. It's more like fruit leather. It's like
Gotcha.
a treat you pick up with your fingers and you eat like that. They didn't actually spread any of their jam on bread, but they do have recipes for tarts, fruit tarts, where you use equivalent to jam consistency type
I see.
Spread.
Okay. So your book, Cooking, wait, is it Cooking with the Tutors or
Eating?
Eating with the Tutors.
It means cooking as well.
Eating, cooking, domesticating.
Yeah.
Jeez. Eating with the Tutors. You can get it on Amazon, on all of the places. And you've seen copies of it in lots of bookshops around. I see you on Facebook when you're like,
yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. It's quite lovely to see your book somewhere. <Yeah. laughs> It makes it feel real. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, you are a delight. Nobody came on the call live, but that's okay. I've taped this now. So we're going to put this out in lots of places and hopefully get a lot of book sales for you. I'm going to put it in my newsletter too and have a link. And I'm just so grateful. You're just fantastic. I just appreciate you so much.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm very excited about being able to come to Tudor Con this year again. It's been too long.
Has 5 years.
Yeah, I know. So I did say it to my husband. I said, we've got to go. Honestly, it's about time we go again. I miss it so badly.
Oh, so we're all fingers crossed,
we'll make it.
Yeah. Well, you're speaking. You got to make it.
I am. Yes.
So Eating with the Tutors. And you are just a delight. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much for chatting to me about my passion.
Oh, you make it all so in, like, I'm really interested now because of the way you are so passionate. It comes through and I'm just like, I have no interest in cooking. And yet with you, like, I suddenly want to go try out a bunch of recipes. So thank you.
Well, Tudor cooking is different, isn't it?
Yeah. That's true. I have your book and I am going to go try. I hadn't tried out any recipes because, like I say, I'm not really that much of a cook, but you've inspired me. So I'll let you know how it goes.
Excellent.
All right. Well, thank you again. I appreciate you. Thank you. We'll see you at TudorCon.
Yes.
Yay. All right. Thank you.
Blow, northern wind, a sandful may be sweating. Blow, northern wind, blow, blow, blow. Ich hot a board in Bauerbrick, at Sulis emnis on sich. Mensch full maiden of mich, fair and freight of wonder. In all this world, fleisch a one, a board of blood and of bone. Never yet in Ustenon, not so merry.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.